Selze, so welcome to the Commerce Talks podcast. Today we are talking about the CPG, FMCG industry and their digital transformation, or maybe not. That's what we're going to find out in the podcast. Before we are diving into the details of the industry transformation, please introduce yourself and what you're doing for PepsiCo.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, first and foremost, for having me, Alex. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've been leading e-commerce for PepsiCo Europe for 4 years now, and it has been a terrific journey of transformation, as you say, right? So, but my role is basically two major missions: driving the growth and you know, running the P&L of the channel in a transversal manner across the region, and developing the capabilities that we need to win in the markets, but also become a vehicle for the broader company to develop capabilities needed to win in the future, right?
And what does it exactly mean? So if you're looking it from a CPG like PepsiCo on this kind of market, because if I remember correctly, say when it started like 5-6 years ago, the e-commerce share of this industry was super low, apart from UK. UK was kind of always leading, but the rest of Europe was super low. So most of the companies I was speaking to were handling it as kind of a side project. You know, it's not important for us, or we try out some stuff. We put some online shops live and let's see what's going to happen. So is it still the status quo, or has it changed?
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. So the pandemic, of course, gave us a boost in adoption in many markets, and many markets caught up with the UK and even surpassed for a while the UK level of the adoption. From a consumer standpoint, I think the UK consumers are still ahead, right, in terms of digital savviness and whatnot. And F&B, as you know, CPGs in general, but F&B specifically is a laggard on adoption. Still today, right, we're still behind many, many categories. And depending on the reading, we're second to last, third to last, or something in terms of level of adoption, which doesn't mean it's not sizable today, right? And it doesn't mean it's growing very fast still. So we had, of course, an explosion in the pandemic, but the adoption and the growth of the business in general across the region is still very strong.
And like from an adoption standpoint, and maybe it's kind of a this kind of glass bowl view. I had a discussion with two industry experts at a conference like last year. So one was from the FMCG retail side, so running a couple of stores, and the other one was from a rather like modern delivery business called Picnic, which is, from my point of view, one of the most interesting businesses. And we discussed that what version of the business is needs less manual labor, because our assumption was that manual labor, because of demographic shift in Europe, will be the most expensive ingredient in the whole like transactional chain. And it was unclear somehow, because the argument from the store person was, you know, we can do a lot of revenue like with one person in the store, because most of the stuff is done by the customer, like picking, packing, logistics, whatever. So per person revenue is higher than on the delivery side. Versus on the delivery side, the argument was, that might be true, but we don't need a store. We just have one in warehouse, so we like pick the merchandise like less anyway. So every item is picked at least 1, 2, 3 times less compared to the other thing. And we still need to figure out last mile, and when last mile will be a bit more autonomous, we can definitely beat store. And then I thought, okay, that must be kind of the leading thinking principle of CPG companies like PepsiCo, because eventually the model with like less manual labor will succeed and will be like the dominating model. Do we have a view on that?
Yeah, so that's a great point, right? And I love the way you break it down to the problem, I guess, to its most fundamental level, right? Which is really who is going to do the work. And there's when I was first starting, we set out to build a strategic plan, right? So, okay, so given the pandemic boosts, we realized we needed to develop a lot of capabilities that we hadn't until that point. And we set out a new aspiration in the light of this explosion, and also a roadmap for building those capabilities, right? And one thing we tried to anticipate or forecast or plan for, Alex, was the sub-channel or the formats or the digital go-to-market shape in the future, right? And that was precisely wrong, of course, right? The mix of sub-channels that we anticipated would be the mix that we have today was completely wrong, because it used the past to extrapolate into the future. And you know, formats have risen and fallen, and there's a lot of volatility in the sub-channels. You mentioned Picnic, but we had the rise and fall, I guess, from quick commerce. And when I say fall, is, I guess, the model of the micro-fulfillment center in urban areas doesn't work everywhere, right? To your point, the labor, the real estate regulations, this is going to vary dramatically, city by city even, right? It's not even country by country. So this brought a lot of challenges to the quick commerce players. And now what we see emerging as the winning model is more the aggregator model, right? Where you tap into the footprint of the traditional players to fulfill the orders. And then to your question on order economics, to be honest, we don't have full visibility. Depending on the partner, we have more data, less data on our baskets, on our role on the baskets. But they are full baskets. We don't have clarity on how good or bad is the order economics, right? But we did have discussions around this, and at some point we figured we don't have to solve for the order economics as a whole, right? Because there are other categories implied and whatnot. We need to make sure our products are attractive enough for the players, right? And it's a very similar thinking to your point. On a fundamental level, our products were always high rotation and good margins for the retailers, right? And that's what we needed to offer to the new players as well, to the emerging players as well.
And just going back to the leading model from your point of view, you're saying the aggregator model is the one where you see like best traction right now. What is an aggregator model in your, is it kind
yes,
of
in our,
Info yeah. Shop, Instacart, what is it?
Yes, exactly. So it's Instacart and equivalents, European equivalents, right? So Deliveroo, Glovo. Glovo has both, actually, right? It's a hybrid. Just Eat Takeaway. Mostly the guys that start Uber Eats, they started with the food service delivery. In the case of Uber, with the rides app, right? But and they have numerous models now. Most of them have some sort of dark store model as well, or intermediary distribution centers and whatnot to support the logistics. But they're based on gig economy and another player's footprint, generally speaking, right? And I think that's the model that still can fulfill a very quick demand occasion, which is very important for us. For the snacks and bevs category in a cost efficient manner, right?
Okay, got it. But so when I'm looking at those different models and I look at this aggregator model, my perception is this aggregator model uses an infrastructure that was built for logistics by end customers, and therefore is rather inefficient, because the merchandise, like the PepsiCo merchandise, needs to go to like a central warehouse, regional warehouse. From there, it goes to the different warehouses from your retailing partners. In Germany, it's kind of Rewe, Edeka, whatever. In Switzerland, it's other ones. In Austria, it's Hofer. And then the customer comes. So it's a lot of like manual labor involved until like the merchandise like lands at the kitchen table of the customer. The aggregator models just like are built on top, adding a layer of complexity where more like direct to consumer models with like with warehouses, inner city warehouses from the quick commerce players, or more regional warehouses like the Picnics and Knuspers and Rohlik group of this world, for me seem to me way more like cost efficient. Or is it just like a timing perspective? So they might outperform the older model like over time, but right now the aggregator model is a winning model.
Yeah. So that's on the cost side of things, I agree with you, right? It's an added layer to an existing cost base that is not necessarily efficient, to your point, right? That's the retail structure in general, right? But from a consumer standpoint, in terms of convenience, I think the quick commerce or the aggregators serving this rapid delivery occasion is the ultimate convenience, right? And I think, to your point on manual labor involved, I think the evolution of technology will start lowering the order economics cost, right? The unit order costs, I mean, with more and more automation on all steps of the chain, right, of the value chain, and optimizations as well, not only automation, but all the intelligence itself is going to get better and better. And I think in the long run, the cost, the unit cost of fulfilling is going to go down, which then is going to make it possible to go even further or faster fulfilling this occasion, right? And the consumer will always go for the most convenient option, right? Even if you have to segment and charge a premium for convenience, there's a segment of the consumers that are going to go for it, right? So that's, I guess, what I meant. Yeah.
Okay, but let's stick with the statement for like a minute, the convenience statement.
Yeah.
Because you might follow me on LinkedIn. So I published a lot of stuff on Temu and Shein.
Yeah.
The last 12 months, and the convenience assumption was one of the main assumptions driving the e-commerce economy last couple of years. So the faster, the bigger the selection, the faster you can deliver, the better the price, you're going to win. And now we have like new competition from China that is like taking away fulfillment, saying, okay, you have to wait like 8 weeks, but you can save 20% of the money and you're getting the same product. And if you like ask customers would rather say, no, I'd like to have it like tomorrow, or I'd like to have a more sustainable retail approach where people pay taxes and customs, blah blah blah. But eventually they follow the money, so the cheapest provider wins. And I was asking me if this can also be true for your industry. So obviously brands do play a little bit different role in your industry, but like if you look at the retail stores, they more and more push their own brands, the private label brands into the store. And customers are buying it, especially now in economically tough times, especially in Germany, where we are usually very, very tight on FMCG spending. So we are rather focusing on house and car and whatever, and not so much on. And like half a year ago, I would have bought your convenience argument. Yeah, convenience is kind of the driving force. Today, I would rather say, okay, if the customer can buy a PepsiCo product, let's assume the brand is important still, but if or she can buy the product 10% cheaper on a channel which is a bit less convenient, a very big chunk of customers would go there for economic reasons or for irrational like German FMCG buyer reasons. Nobody has nobody figured out why this is. But I'd like to challenge it a bit. So
yeah, I love it.
Stick with your convenience argument.
Yes, I'm going to stick to it at least partially, and I will explain to you why. Have you, before leading e-commerce, I led revenue management at PepsiCo and actually at J&J as well. And I worked as a consultant with pricing as well. So I have quite a few years of experience with pricing and elasticities and whatnot. And there is this analysis that's called Van Westendorp, I think, is the name. I don't know if you've seen this analysis. This X of elasticity and consumption, their breaking points. And of course, economists draw elasticities as a very smooth line for ease of translating the concept, right? But the reality is that it has steps on it, and sometimes it's steep declines on volume because you hit what we call a magical price point, or you know, too sensitive of a threshold on consumption. So to your point, and why I'm going to stick to my convenience point partially, is I think there's going to be always a segment that is going to move dramatically up or down, right? The quantity or the volume that you're going to tap into is going to go dramatically up or down if you cross one of those thresholds, right? But there's also a significant cohort that won't move even if you cross that threshold. So I think the convenience cohort's always going to be there. And of course, the sensitivity on the cost, it's always going to be there as elasticity, right? And there's going to be a nuance, and there's going to be this breaking points, and there's this flow of people to one side or the other, right?
Okay, got it. Okay, okay. You're sticking with it based on this kind of survey and study. Yeah,
it's basic elasticity, right?
Okay. But
there's one thing I learned on pricing is that if you raise the price, the volume's gonna go down, Alex.
yes, this I've heard in business administration. If you're so you've had a very very successful trajectory so far at PepsiCo with like the e-commerce business.
Yeah.
If I were to look back in time, a couple of years ago, talking with CPG companies, they always said, okay, we don't want to go direct to consumer because it doesn't make sense for our line of products. Nobody wants to buy like a single pack of toothpaste stuff. Then packaging doesn't make sense anymore, or drinks. And then a lot of like new businesses like Picnic and others entered the market. Like in Germany, you had Flash and Post, which was acquired by Oetker Group last year, which kind of changed the approach. Still, not so many companies have had success in a direct to consumer approach because they're just like organized in a very different way. And it's sometimes hard to ship, hard to manage. It's kind of a very different business model. So can you take us a bit with you on the transformation journey you have done with PepsiCo and what you have achieved? And are you selling now direct to customers, competing with Rewe, or what's the point?
So let me start with the transformation, right? And it's a great segue on the pivot as well, the D2C piece of it. But the my tagline, and you saw my LinkedIn, right? It's 2x, 3x, 4x. We double the team, we triple the revenues, we quadruple the profits, which is something we're very, very proud of here. Doubling the team means, you know, not only the quantity, but we brought a lot of great talent, elevated seniority, expertise. It's a great team that we have now. We tripled the revenues, meaning we beat the market as well. So we captured share in the long run. So that's great as well. And of course, the profitability growing faster than revenues means we improved the P&L shape of the business, right? So it's a massively successful journey. And like all successful journeys, we need to pivot now, right? To keep succeeding. And your question on D2C is a perfect segue in this discussion, because PepsiCo is a very sales-oriented company, right? Sales-driven, sales-oriented. So we used to frame e-commerce as a sales channel. And to your earlier question, right, on the journey, it was really a small sales channel at first. So no one really cared. And there was an explosion during COVID. And now we're growing at an accelerated pace and still delivering a disproportional growth contribution, right? So our percentage of the business is X. Our percentage to growth contribution is 3X, right? So this means we're gonna only grow in importance looking ahead, right? And then this D2C discussion was, okay, so D2C is a small part of this small part of the business as a sales channel, but the pivots we're thinking about and going about now in the internal discussions is e-commerce is much more than a sales channel, as you know, Alex. It's also a very powerful consumer engagement platform, a very powerful capability building platform, and as well a sales channel, right? So if you expand the vision into this consumer engagement pillar, then D2C becomes critical, right? As part of the overarching brand experience you want to provide to your consumer, right? And it must be consistent in an omni-channel, multifunctional manner, right? So in all channels, you should provide a consistent experience, but also it needs to be consistent with all your brand building and engagement efforts, right? And that's where I see D2C as an important part of it, right? We need to take good care of our .com assets, making them shoppable, and learning as much as we can from those transactions, but also using it as a means of engaging consumers, giving price and value references and whatnot, right?
But what does it mean, like, in a D2C perspective? Again, like, I'm recalling meetings where we discussed, okay, can we do this and that, like D2C thing, set up a simple e-commerce shop, do some online marketing to learn D2C, not to compete with the other retailers, but to get closer to customers. Because as you said, the company is rather far away from the customers. So you obviously like drive branding campaigns and there are some loyalty programs, but you don't know who is buying, when he or she is buying, what are they exactly buying, how happy they are with the product itself. Only when there's like concerns about the product and people are not happy, then you will know about. But when everything is fine, you only get like the negative side. So, and then this kind of D2C projects I've seen were often meant as kind of lead gen, getting people more in this kind of loyalty programs kind of stuff. It usually was a headache because it still was not a fit with the existing business model, which is kind of a wholesale business model.
Yes.
It never really fulfilled the demand of the customer who just wanted to have like, I don't know, maybe exclusive products, more products, better prices, whatever. And eventually those projects have been delayed or stopped because they were not they only created channel conflict. So people were calling, so what is PepsiCo or what is like Unilever doing there? They are selling products now. Do they want to become a competitor now? That's not partnership, blah blah blah, all this stuff, you know. But this still feels like a 2015 discussion. So is it still the case or has it changed?
No, it is a journey, right? And I think a few elements that you outlined are still part of the discussion, but and I think you're absolutely right. CPGs got used to being very transactional, right? That way, so I go there, negotiate the terms, and sell to my retail partners a few times a year, but I negotiate once or twice a year, and that's it, right? And those terms are there for a while, and then they go on and sell to our consumers, right? And now, in this day and age, you can't afford to do only that anymore, right? You must establish this dialogue with the consumer. And that's what I mean when I say D2C. It's all the assets and medias and parties, internal and external stakeholders involved in this dialogue need to work in a more deliberate manner, right? And in this dialogue. But to your point, I think it's a journey, and I think there's still a lot of coordination needed, right? So looking ahead.
Yeah. To my big surprise, the market has changed in a way that is solving this channel conflict, because now more and more retailers say, we don't want to take the product risk anymore, especially like the retailers that have been like competing with online platforms like Amazon, which is not yet the case in your industry, but it becomes the case.
Yeah.
And if you look at the IPO information from Instacart, you're seeing that 90% of their EBITDA is made by retail media revenues. Though the retail and logistics business model itself is not able to create like meaningful EBITDA anymore. So they have to sell media to FMCG companies or CPG companies like you are. They say, okay, yep, sales rep, we can list your products on the top in the beverage categories or snack categories, but you have to pay. And if you deep dive into the IPO data, then you're seeing on an average order of $110, $3 is retail media revenue. So the FMCG companies are buying this kind of revenue. And out of a sudden, though, the table is turned and the risk is moving back into your perspective, where you can decide now, okay, do you want to spend retail media at an aggregator, or do you want to spend this same amount of money into your own channels, bringing your customers to your products in a different way? So do I describe it correctly? Is it kind of really turning the tables, or is it? Do you feel more comfortable around what Instacart and others are doing? And regardless what retailer we would pick here from the European retail catalog, they all have retail media on top of their strategic initiatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should, right, Alex? I think retail media is going to be a massive transformation agent, both for the media industry, but also for the commerce industry or retail industry, as you're alluding to, right, I think. And if I understood you correctly, I think that the inventory risk was never passed fully to our retail partners, right? There's always trade terms, negotiations, contracts, and whatnot around. And we have also our internal controls to avoid channel stuffing and stuff like that, right? So I would argue the risk was never fully passed along the chain, but it's more of a partnership or a commercial relationship, right? And then to your point, I love the way you decompose problems to a fundamental level, Alex. I was reading this book from Charlie Munger, you know, the partner of Warren Buffett, and he speaks a lot about this, right? And so I love that. So if you think about retailers and media, it's about traffic and conversion, right? At its most fundamental level. What am I paying when I'm advertising? Of course, there's the longer term brand building aspect of it. But if you think full funnel, I'm going to pay for conversion, right? And it's the same thing for retailers, because we do have sometimes, depending on the contract and whatnot, have to pay for space as well, for extra space for sure, and for promotions. And so you do have to pay for space to tap into that footfall that they have on their stores. Right. So if you think about the business nature, is not that different. The difference now with retail media networks is that retailers are realizing they have an unstructured or not the best way to sell their media assets in a sense. Right. And now they're stepping up their game, and we're seeing a lot of investments in, OK, so let's package this and let's make sure we sell this in a more integrated manner. And there's a lot of, you know, different stages of evolution depending on player and assets and whatnot. But I would say the retail in general is now gearing up to become a proper media player, right? So I think that's why I think this may change the media landscape as much as the retail landscape, right? It's a new type of animal competing there.
I understand that this is competing with. So I see where you draw like the parallel. So it's more or less you have to spend $10 for getting the best aisle place in the store. Now you have to pay the same amount of money for being listed on top in the on the search category in the store. But does it mean that you would shift media budget you would have spent into like TV or national campaign into those channels? So is it this kind of budget that has been shifted?
Yes, it must be. And I think then I need to take a personal standpoint here, right? But personally, I think the funding is still an open discussion, right? Because you have separated buckets of resources today in CPGs for trade investments, meaning today physical trade investments. And then let's put quote unquote brand building or advertising investments in a different bucket, right? And as the boundaries of what is a trade vehicle or media or type of player and what is a media type of player are blurring, right? Media players are becoming retailers and retailers are becoming media players. So the funding discussion within the CPGs is still to me an open discussion, right? So where are you going to source and how are you going to account for those investments in the most efficient, effective manner? And then, yes, if the offerings become relevant, good enough, with enough transparency, enough data, tracking all the measurements that we need to make sure they are relevant and effective medias, yes, then definitely we will shift resources there, right? It's always a narrow eye discussion. And my marketing colleagues would kill me if I didn't say that. We must make sure we're looking at both short-term ROI and longer-term ROI as well, right?
Okay, got it. So you've been working also the LATAM market. Obviously, PepsiCo is a US-based company, so you've seen like many different aspects of this transformation. I'm not sure how deep you are in the APAC market, but from the markets you have been seeing so far, what is the furthest developed e-commerce market for food and beverages globally from your perspective today?
Yeah, so I have limited visibility from APAC, but it's always China and South Korea are always references in terms of adoption, right? The size of the online business for every category there is light years ahead of us here in Europe. US is somewhere in between, and then LATAM is a little bit of a laggard, right? That said, I have more visibility from my US colleagues and references, because usually they translate better to our European legal framework, cultural framework, than my Asian colleagues.
Okay, and then there's like one. My last question is: there's one list of in the FMCG industry I always wanted to discuss. Now, as we are seeing kind of a global recession, part maybe from India, but most markets do have like have a tough time. Then I'm always hearing that corner stores or tienditas, like this very small stores where FMCG products are sold, do have like a better time, even outgrowing the supermarket infrastructure. So in Germany, nobody knows like corner stores, maybe apart from Berlin, where you have like some kiosks infrastructure. This is kind of the store principle you see on a global level in Asia, in South America, in most all of the African countries, in Russia. So is this true? Do you see a rise of the corner stores right now instead of the rise of the supermarket chains? Because before somebody told me that, I always believed that the supermarket model must be the dominating model. And whenever you've started the supermarket journey, there's no way back. But now I'm rethinking this and say, okay, maybe there's a way back when people have to spend daily income on their food and beverage needs.
So let me give you an insight from my days in LATAM, right? And it's a little dated, but I think it holds and helps confirm your hypothesis there, Alex. But one important thing about the corner store, and they have different names, right? In Mexico, the changarros and the tienditas and things like that, is their connection with the local community, local neighborhood. Sometimes their customers are neighbors and friends. And sometimes they do stop by and shop there to actually help their friend or neighbor or colleague, right, in need. So this is a powerful pool that no big retailer or supermarket will ever be able to replicate, right? And this is true for other types of channels there in LATAM as well, like the door-to-door model Avon used to have, Natura, now it's acquired Avon. The door-to-door model is the same thing, right? They buy stuff that they don't need sometimes just to help their friend or neighbor that's a representative of these companies, right? And that's a powerful insight I had there doing, you know, market research on the field and stuff like that for the pricing work we were doing.
Okay, and then I have one very last question. So as you said. Adoption-wise, we are super far away from like China and South Korea. But in some markets in Europe, you see almost 10% of food and beverage is like already traded online. Yeah. Netherlands and UK are far ahead from my point of view. When do we see this in Swiss or in Germany or France? What's your best guess?
I think Germany has, I'm based in Switzerland, but it's not such a relevant market for us. So I'm ashamed to admit I don't know the market so much, only as a consumer. But in Germany, I know there's one thing that's, a couple of things, right? So there's a store saturation that's higher than any other market in Europe. Mm-hmm. So it's really close to go to a store on average, right, for people. So I think that's a major factor. And it's the homeland of the hard discounters, right? So it's terrific value for money propositions for a long while, right? So I think those are two massively important factors on why the landscape in Germany is different.
But again, so what is your, from a year perspective, would you say 10% can, today I think in Germany we are at 2% online share. So 10% is a lot in a $250 billion market. So when do you think we can achieve it? Until 2030 or rather 35, 40?
Oh, no, before. I think before. I think we're very close already. Well, then again, right, I speak from our experience and our segment of the market, but also from numbers I've seen on market researches out there. The 10%, I think, definitely is going to come sooner rather than later. And of course, our ambitions and aspirations is to drive this even faster. And then depends on how you define the penetration as well, right? So because we have this internal segmentation, so for instance, the numbers I have in my mind don't consider the B2B part. Sometimes it doesn't consider the food service part, which is all online driven. So it depends on how you define the number as well. This percentage may be even higher and or come quicker, right, Alex? But I'm confident the percentage is going to keep growing, and eventually we will get to not necessarily Chinese exactly the same level, but as high as a penny. There's also there's another insight I must share, is the generational insight. So the adoption, I did a cut of the data on the adoption, the cohorts, the younger cohorts, Gen Zs and millennials, they already over-index in e-com, right, adoption. And their numbers are much closer to Chinese numbers than, of course, the average of the markets. So in due time, just by generational tailwinds, we're going to get closer to that.
So you're seeing there's like, for the younger cohorts, there's like even more demand than offers, because, for example, in my village, I cannot even order online. So there's no delivery services. So it's a question of availability of delivery options, and then the adoption will increase
I think there's a I think there's a couple of maybe it's a Lollapalooza type of thing where several factors will converge to this, right? But one is the retail media networks. It's going to throw more investments on online as because it's such an important part of the media offering, which in turn will give more profits and incentives to reinvest from the retail side on better experiences. So to your point, I think that's going to have a tailwind there. There's the generational tailwind. And coupled with the generational tailwinds, these generations are making more and more money. So millennials are reaching their peak money-making years on their ages and careers. And Gen Zers are entering the market now, so ramping up very fastly their earnings. So this means they will have even more money, more decision-making on the baskets. Their share in the total retail space is going to grow faster than, you know, the population growth. So I think these things combined is fuel for continued accelerated growth for e-commerce, digital commerce.
Yeah. Got it. Very interesting. So if you, as you're saying, we will reach the 10% barrier way further, we can compare numbers like in maybe end of 2025. Let's see where this will lead us. So Celso, thank you for your time. Seeing you soon in Berlin.